This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector. Investigative conversations about issues that impact our lives. Be curious. Friday mornings at 9 a.m. only on 101.9 High FM.
And we are live. And this is indeed The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, and we're with you till 10 o'clock this morning. And it is a real pleasure, and it is something of an honor as well, to have my Daily Maverick colleague, Ferial Hafaji, as our conversation partner today. By way of introduction, Ferial is a well-known, respected globally journalist and analyst. She's edited two major newspapers in this country in her life. She's written an important, interesting, and controversial book, What If There Were No Whites in South Africa, I think was the correct title. And I read it and found myself making all kinds of marginal notes to keep track of my thinking on it. Ferial is, how shall we put it? She's a reporter, a writer, an analyst who seems in the present moment poised between anger and despair and hope. On the one hand, angry that the city that she grew up in has come to where it is, and the promise of the country hasn't actually come through in so many ways, disappointingly, but hope, because she's really convinced about the resilience of the South African people to make it work in spite of everything. And I think those qualities shine through in her writing. And let me just add that on the entry foyer to her house, which just coincidentally is around the corner from mine, she has this wonderful photograph of a panoramic view of Johannesburg by Guy Tillam, which really speaks to that quality of anger and hope and despair all mixed together. Beautiful picture, and it tells a story that you can see in great detail. And by way of further introduction, she just happened to have gone to the same high school that my wife did. So we feel that we have a connection, a deep and organic connection to Ferial, our neighbor, our colleague, our friend, and someone whose views and opinions I respect a great deal. Ferial, I'm glad you could join us today.
Good morning, Brooks. It's lovely to be with you and to be in conversation with you.
Let me pose this question to you. Are you really chronicling anger and fear and despair on the one side, and hope and appreciation of resilience of the South African people on the other? Is the balance swinging one way versus the other, or are you somehow in the middle of that?
You know, Brooks, I try not to be impelled to action through anger ever. But what I am is deeply disappointed in the stewards of our city, who I don't think appreciate their stewardship at all and are either self-concerned or inadequate to the task of managing an historically and presently interesting, dynamic, energetic city. So I guess that's what makes me write as I do, and to keep an eagle eye on Johannesburg, which really is not in great condition on the one hand in those areas where city governance manages. But if you look at culture, at its growth, you can see the energy of the people who drive the city forward. It really is those South African qualities of resilience, ambition, all the things that have been with Johannesburg from its present and I think exist now too, perhaps not at City Hall, but definitely in the city itself.
And I'm tempted to say that what you're writing about the city now is a view from the pothole, particularly because we all encounter them. We all drive through, around, over, and sometimes even under them. But what I'm trying to get at is, where are your, which way is your feeling going? Are you reasonably convinced that the city, because of its people, can get out of the doldrums, or are you fearful that maybe this is the inevitable downward slide into irrelevance? I mean, cities do disappear, cities do die, and populations do move historically. It's not inevitable that a city stays around forever.
It certainly isn't. I mean, one of my favorite books is Cities of Destiny, and that shows you that some cities exist through the times. They go through ups and downs, but they remain great cities of destiny. Others like Persepolis, many that we can think of, Alexandria, they fall by the way as the global sands of time shift. I guess my concern is for the Johannesburg here and now, and for the 6 million people who call it home, and how do we make it a better home for all? So I'll tell you about a Johannesburg roundtable organized by my friend Bruce Robertson, together with Professor Nick Bernadel. It brings together about 30 leaders of the city, and I was with them a couple of weeks ago. And really, I came away from that feeling that with leaders like those, we have to understand city leadership differently, and you have to maintain a sense of excitement and hope. And I'll just tell you about a few of them. So there was Bia Potgieter, who's of Josie My Josie. It's a project started by the business community, but including civil society, including the city itself. And they have set themselves a couple of key tasks. So the one that they've done, and I think you'd really love this, is that Nelson Mandela Bridge, that beautiful, iconic bridge linking Braamfontein to the inner city, had fallen into significant disrepair. I know you go to the Market Theatre very often, and you'd have seen sometimes heading back home from there that it wasn't lit any longer, and that it had become quite dangerous for people who use it as a pedestrian bridge. So Josie My Josie got together with the city, and they've replaced all the lights and with solar lighting. When Bia was chatting to me last week, she said that they had they were replacing the glass panels as well. Security had been put back on the bridge, and what had happened on either side was that small and medium-sized businesses, which had seen their footfall near completely decimated, suddenly found that their businesses were thriving again. And what I learned from that is that sometimes it takes a small action by committed people to see a resurgence or a remaking of something which we may have thought that was just going to go to the dogs. One thing I'm really looking forward to is their next big project is to look at the 12 city on-ramps and off-ramps, the places where people come into the city or leave it. And now we'd have seen when we do, whether you're coming from the airport, whether you're entering from the Gautrains, whether you're entering from east, south, north, west of the city, all those on-ramps have become one, dangerous, two, overgrown, and not very pleasant entrees into Johannesburg. That's their next port of call, to fix them, clean them, make them safe. And just their methodical can-do approach to their work, I think, taps into a spirit of Johannesburg that I'm pretty excited about. I'm not excited about the people who run the city, Brooks. I don't think they're up to the task. But I do imagine a future of co-governance. And we're seeing that everywhere. It's not a future theory. We can see it in our own areas where governance is very much done by WhatsApp group and by getting to know the good people in the Joburg Roads Agency or City Power or Johannesburg Water. And I think it's there where we're going to, how we're going to see Johannesburg working.
Years ago, I actually bought a box of books, all copies of the same book, it was called From Joburg to Josie.
Yes. Edited.
You remember it, I'm sure. And the introduction had this wonderful image of the highways leading into the city, the railroads leading into the city, like it was some sort of emerald city right out of The Wizard of Oz. And that spoke to the hopefulness and the possibility. And we're going to come back to this question of possibilities after this quick station break. We have to do this. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host. And I'm pleased my guest is Ferial Haffajee, a colleague from the Daily Maverick with a long and impressive resume in reportage and analysis. We'll be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And we are back. This is The Deep Dive. I am Brooke Spector, and I'm really pleased my guest today is Ferial Haffajee, editor of newspapers, correspondent, analyst, and cheerleader for Johannesburg, if I might even add that. Just before the break, we were talking about the way in which not even government, but associations of individuals, voluntary associations, groups of neighbors and business friends have gotten together to address city problems. Is that going to take the place of an inept and inefficient city government? Can activities like that actually elbow the city out of the way and get things done?
I think you might help us here in looking at Detroit as a model. I don't think you can ever say, and I hear some people do, is like, just ignore the city, let's get on with things. It's 76 billion rand a year city with lots of people running it. It's a massive metropolitan area. So I don't think you can reach the point where some towns have, where you just discount the presence of municipal government as a factor in your life. No, it's too big, too important. So I think it has to be a mixture of partnership and pressure. And so Josie My Josie has gone the one direction of partnership, work with the best people, try and make the city look good, get the agreements, the way leaves you need to do all the things that they're doing. And I guess then it falls to journalism to do the accountability work, where you have to make sure that the city doesn't fall prey to the state capture we saw at national level taking place at local level, and it really does. I mean, that's a big part of my work, is to understand how that happens and why it happens. But we can't let that happen, because as Reedy Klaube has been repeatedly pointing out, Johannesburg rates and utility charges are higher than, you know, she's been living in London and then in Washington. And she says that she's done detailed comparisons which shows that our city is either on a par with or more expensive than by those charges, not general ones, but certainly by those.
One of the things that, of course, we can't ignore, because some of your reporting in the last couple of months certainly has focused on it, is, and I almost dread using the word, the election that's coming up.
Yes.
I guess we can't avoid it. But what I want you to help explain to us is how the processes you have been just talking about, how they are informing the way people you have talked to, who will be voters, how they're processing the idea of their choice. I'm not, as you can see, I'm trying to avoid asking for a prediction on who's going to win and by how much.
I'm glad you don't. I'm very glad you don't. So, you know, I've spent quite a bit of time on the road and going to things, and I think people are urban people that I've spoken to are making choices that are not based on history any longer. I think they're interested in new parties. I think they're interested in the shape of governance. I think they're concerned about the state of South Africa, and so they're not making choices looking back any longer. There are a sizable number of people who I think are voting their fears of the future, kind of a defensive vote. There are a sizable number of people in the Western Cape who are voting with a kind of UDI. They want this, the Western Cape and Cape Town, to be almost annexed from the rest of South Africa. Big support for either overtly or covertly for the idea of Cape independence and therefore difference. And then there are, I think, a significant number of people who are voting for history and present, and let me say for the ANC, because the party still does deliver change in their lives. And it would be naive and churlish of us not to recognize that. These are the people who have received houses. These are the people who get grants. These are the people who are employed in massive numbers on the expanded public works programs through the state run by the ANC. And I think for reasons of history and present, they will still ensure that the ANC turns out the highest number of votes. It may not be a majority, but it still is going to be the biggest number of votes.
But balancing or counterbalancing that sense is, I guess it's probably fair to say, a sense of, I don't want to use the word betrayal, that's probably too strong, but deep disappointment that the promises that have been earnestly and sometimes too casually made by the governing party, the people look around and say, yeah, well, you promised this, you promised that, and look where we are now. Maybe I should look elsewhere. Is that a feeling that you're picking up as you travel about in that SUV that you've been writing about?
I have to say, I think betrayal and the big words like rescue and so on, they are they're not words that I hear people use. You know, I think that that's the language of the commentariat and punditocracy, which is my, I'm part of that too, you know, betrayal of the promise, etc., etc. That's not language I hear. What I do hear a lot, and it's borne out in the Indlulamiti scenarios, which is the biggest baseline study of the feelings of South Africans, is more disappointment and concern for their lives. So load shedding, water, jobs, these are the three issues that come up again and again and again. And for me, the way I read that, especially in the metropolitan areas, is we want a way in, especially in Gauteng, the richest province in the country still. We want a way in to this world that we see nestling so close by. So not betrayal. I think that's because those of us who understood the nature of what happened was so big in the world. But it's not language, to be honest, Brooks, that I hear on the campaign trail. I hear disappointment, I hear anger, I hear people who can see that the insiders are getting opportunities, but that they continue to be left on the outside of things. So, which is why I think characters of the outside, like Julius Malema, like Gayton McKenzie, even the former president, Jacob Zuma, a man of the inside, is creating a persona of a person of the outside with those people who've been left behind. And he's doing so very, very successfully.
I mean, the moment you gave that list of the things that that you hear the most, I can't help it. I was drawn to the idea of a comparison to the United States, which is also having, dare I say, yes, an election this year. The polls, when you ask not who's winning, but when you ask about the issues, it's not the ones that most people might think of immediately. It's immigration, and inflation, price inflation. Those are the driving issues for most people. Those, in a curious way, are what you might call kitchen table issues, because people, they either affect people directly or at least they perceive that they affect them directly in their wallets or in their daily lives. And it's not the big issues of war and peace or how do we solve the national debt or, you know, what about foreign involvement in Ukraine? Those are the issues to a considerable degree of the commentariat. And
yes, exactly that. I think it's like dining table, kitchen table, or for me, the social relief of distress grant Q, which are the conversations that will drive our election too.
Yeah, I mean, and if you write about the elections, it's easy to sort of slide into the big issues, and it's much harder to maintain a focus on these quote unquote small issues. Excuse me, sorry. How do you do it? How do you yourself? How do you manage to slide away from the big pictures to the focus on the individual as he, she, they think about these things? How do you do it?
You know, I guess it's a balance. Like right now, I'm thinking for the past 4 to 6 weeks, I've been so engaged in the small issues and so interested in what I'm learning that I've perhaps pulled away from the big issues too much and feel like as journalists we have to give a sense of this is the macro trend, this is where the country is heading, this is how things are shaping where you live. You know, I do audience engagement for the Daily Maverick, and people are desperate for that kind of big picture. They do want to know, what does the big picture mean for my life? So we have to do a fair bit of that. But I have been absolutely, I'm so happy to have been out there on the road again, because it does give you the raison d'etre for being a journalist, which is how I started in 94. Is really going to understand why people stood in those snaking queues for as long as they did, to understand their hopes, and there were hopes. There were obviously fears, but there was more hope than fear, and to understand how people make the decisions they do. And this time again, it's been really interesting to go about doing that. So one of the stories I'll write up is about Clarence, where there's no load shedding, not just for these 30 days that we are lucky enough not to have had load shedding now, but they were the first town in the country which reached an agreement with Eskom and said, look, we'll do load reduction as a community together. And how they work to do that, for me, is a story that cuts across the political fissures and divides that we often assume are impervious. They cooperated with each other. This is a DA ward in an ANC municipality, and together they made this decision. I found that really, really an interesting story to report.
What is your playlist in that SUV? What are you listening to keep up your spirits?
I think everything, and a lot of it would be like yours, so rap and jazz and some hip hop, and then some disco, because I still love that. So a lot of Bill Withers. So just letting the playlists roam wild, you know, as we do.
Perhaps it's the cynic in me. I would probably have sneaked in a Janis Joplin tune, "Get It While You Can."
I'll put that one on next time we go out. So I was really inspired by our conversations where you said to me, Shirley, you can do horse race all the time. You know, like polls are saying this and that and that, because I was stuck in that mode. And then you reminded me of the great work of David Smith of The Guardian, now in the US, but based here for a very long time. And how he goes about doing his small stories that tell you the big story. And that's very much what I'm trying to do without the benefit of all the time that he has to go and do that. But he's such a master class in complete respect for whoever he's speaking to, whoever he's reporting about, and always remembering that it's the mosaic which gives you the big picture at the end. Huh?
Just by way of emphasis, David is an old friend, of course, and we sometimes call upon him to help interpret the American political maelstrom on this very program, and he's very generous with time, not least because he's something of a night owl and he's up late, so he can do it at a time when most American residents would be sound asleep.
Yes. He's a real lesson, you know, in how to do that. And, I mean, not to overstate the parallels, but there are parallels between what's unrolling in the U.S. and the South African story. And I love how you navigate us through that with your long history of South Africa. And can I toss a question at you because you have such a story here? How do you feel about where South Africa's come to? Where does it find itself on the eve of the 7th national election and on the eve of a very important weekend in South Africa? We celebrate 30 years of democracy. And I use that word with some care and respect. I still think it's a celebration. Huh?
Okay. The bottom line for me is if I thought the place was perched on a precipice into doom, I would have left. But I'm here. I'm here because it is endlessly fascinating. I have family reasons to stay, and I've invested so much time and energy understanding or trying to understand the place. And at the same time, what you allude to, the something of an ability to draw comparisons and contrasts between this country and my own, that it engages me constantly trying to figure out what's the same, what's different, and why is it different? Because there are parallels, and sometimes the parallels are too easy to make, and that you have to guard against that. I mean,
yes, of course,
there are racial issues in both societies, but they are somewhat different in nature, texture, and history. And we can't fall into the easy trap, which too many journalists do, which is simply a simple, you know, on one hand, there's this, on the other, there's that, and they're both actually the same. And so that's, I retain a certain sense of hopefulness that this country can manage its way out of its predicaments, of which there are many, because there are lots of resources, human and otherwise, available to do it. Ariel, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to go to a station break, and we'll be right back. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and my guest today is the inestimable Ariel Hafaji.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And we are back with our conversation with Ferial Hafaji. Just before we took our breaks, Ferial turned the table on me and asked why I'm here. And as an American, but living in South Africa for what seems like forever, I should note, I first came here in 1975 for 2 years with the U.S. government. And then we came back to Swaziland, Eswatini, in 1987 to 89, and then moved back to South Africa in 1989 to 1992, some fairly extraordinary years, both of those tours. And we came back again in 2001. And at the end of the tour in 2003, my wife, who is South African by birth, turned to me and said, I'm staying. What is your plan? And at that point, I had to decide where did my future lie. And I realized that, yes, we could go back to Washington and I could be one of a host of people trying to find ways to explain foreign events to Americans. But it seemed like it would be much more interesting and more fun to try to interpret this country through the eyes of an American and with American sensibilities on the world. And so it has turned out. And opportunities came along from teaching at WITS to this program to my time with the Daily Maverick from the day it began. I don't regret it because it has been entertaining, but more importantly, it has been educational and personally rewarding for me. And we have at least one daughter who lives permanently in Cape Town as a result of all this. So, Ferial, that's a long-winded answer to your question.
Well, it's an interesting one.
Now, let's move slightly from the focus on the small issues, the potholes, the water, the lack of electricity. They're small in quote marks because they actually are enormously important to each and every person. But you participate in a fair number of seminars and conferences which talk to South Africa's future or where, you know, whither the country and things like that. And from that, what do you draw as the main issues confronting the country in the future? What are the things that make you think, how will they fix or adjust or adapt these things?
So that's a big question.
Yeah,
2 minutes. And they will, of course, and there's many layers to that. But if I would say, is a couple of things which I think lie at the heart of our success is we have to get the economy growing, and I think we have to return our political system from one of power seeking to service rendering, and both of those are, I think, tasks that can be accomplished over the medium term. But what it does require, and technical answer, you have to change the relationship between the government and the governed, because at the moment it's too distant, too far, they pay too much obeisance to the party bosses rather than to the people who elect them. And unless we don't shift that equation, we are not going to see any of the growth, the jobs, the prosperity, which for me is within relatively easy reach if we pull a couple of levers. I mean, you only have to see that how quickly the ports were cleared when South Africans began acting in unison and realizing you needed to, one, change Transnet, two, bring the business sector in, and three, begin to deal with load shedding. So I know people are extremely cynical of the reasons we haven't had load shedding now for 32 days. I do think that an aspect of that is reforms starting to come through. After our conversation, I'm heading to ESCOM to go and seek to understand that more. To understand why that's happened. But I do think reforms, partnerships are beginning to pay off.
We're going to take a quick ad break, and we'll be right back. This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest, Ferial Hafaji, who probably needs very little in the way of introduction, but let me put it this way. She is at the, oh, dare I say it, the coalface, trying to understand our political system in this country and figure out what motivates it, what drives it, what impedes it, and how to fix it. We'll be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And The Deep Dive is back. I am Brooke Spector, and my guest today, I'm pleased, Ferial Hafaji, colleague, neighbor, somebody whose work I've admired for many years. The other week, last week, on this program, as our guest, we had Barbara Masekela, whose name I'm sure Ferial is familiar to you. And we talked about her own career and her life and the things she was interested in. And then unexpectedly, right at the end, she went into an enthusiastic, even a much more than enthusiastic plea to her fellow citizens to not just sit back, but to get out and vote their choice. She didn't specify who her choice was. She just told her fellow citizens, you must get out and vote. It's your future. It's your country. And I'm not trying to elicit from you the same kind of plea, but is there something more than voting that citizens can do to be active citizens engaged in the future of their nation?
So just some geeky stats. I know we're not doing that today, and it's lovely. But 26.7 million people are registered, I think, of a potential voter base of 43 million. So that's a lot of people who don't believe that their well-being, future prosperity, or see the need to go out and vote on May 29th. Of those registered, we know what the numbers could look like. About half of, hopefully more than half, go out to vote on the day, but it could be as low as 50% of people on May 29th, depending on weather, the list factor, etc., etc. What I've learned in Johannesburg in the past few years, Brooks, is that it takes much, much more than going out to vote to be an active citizen. Almost every day I learn from the excellent people here, be it at Defend Our Democracy, be it in the Joburg Crisis Alliance, be it the people who mopped up after the awful fire last year in which so many people died and then had to be moved, is that these acts of citizenship take everything from taking food and blankets to those affected, to holding your councillors to account, to fencing off your substation because it may be vandalized and therefore you lose electricity, to beginning to develop what Mike Saluma calls deep lay engineer characteristics, where we can go and see what's up at a broken pipe because we want to understand why you don't have water and why nobody's fixing it. These are not things we should be doing, but we've been driven there of necessity. And so I see everyday acts of completely redefining what the textbooks may call active citizenship. And surely that's what's going to be the call of us for this coming period.
Almost 200 years ago, the French aristocrat Alexis de Tocqueville was sent to study the prison system in America, which at that time was deemed to be in advance of most other nations. I'm not sure you can make the same point now, but he went and he came back and he wrote one of the most important books about the United States ever, Democracy in America. And the section in particularly that I always reread is about free associations. And he argued that the effectiveness of the American experiment was free associations, people who come together to do everything from put roofs on schools to reorganize their city to the whole range of things. In effect, what you're arguing for is something very similar. I'm going to mail Absolutely. You a copy of the chapter. Mm. You can read it for yourself if you haven't already seen it. Unfortunately, time is now against us, and I'm going to have to draw this to a conclusion.
Such a lovely conversation, dear Brooks. Thank you. Has to be the nicest one I've had all year.
No, well, thank you. Thank you. It's been a pleasure to have you on this. It's a pleasure to have you as a neighbor. It's a pleasure to have you as a colleague and a friend. And our wish to everybody listening, of course, is to think about everything that has been said and to remember it as we wander into the holiday, which is tomorrow, Freedom Day. And I think that's
Thank you very much.
Lots to think about. Mario, take care, have a good weekend, and we'll talk soon.
You too. Bye-bye, Brooks.